In this episode of Shadows from the Tree, we delve into the darker side of genealogy by exploring stories pulled from newspaper archives and using historical records to find the truth behind them. Specifically, the episode focuses on the theme of robbery and the impact it had on the lives of those involved. Join us as we shed light on those often overlooked stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved face, and in hopes connecting you, our listeners, to their stories and their history. Okay, so we decided to do robbery.
Yep.
And I started looking to a few different stories, and I kind of just went with the one that I first read because it had a really good, like, I could picture the scenario in my head, and it captivated me, so I just went with it. And it was titled Diamonds and Opals, an alleged case of sensational larceny. Unlucky combination. A clever capture. So, it was out of the Democrat and Chronicle from New York, Rochester, New York, September 21st, 1897. It's a little older than I typically do.
Yeah, you know, mine's around the same time period, of course. That's where I usually fall.
Yes, yeah, so, and all the articles I found out of this story always linked back to Judson Harmon. So Harmon is the main surname of my story here. And so Judson Harmon was born in Ohio in 1846, and he received a degree from Cincinnati Law School in 1869. And then in 1878, he was elected to the Cincinnati Superior Court, which he held for like a decade.
Wow.
And in 1895, he was appointed the Attorney General under President Cleveland.
Wow.
So, Judson Harmon is actually the sister of the main character that I have here. But I didn't know anything about President Grover Cleveland. Do you?
Not really, no.
Okay. So, this is its own story in itself, which I'm sure there's lots and lots of history on him. So, he was the 22nd and 24th President of the United States. So he was the only president to leave the White House and return for a second term 4 years later.
Yep.
And he was the first Democrat elected after the Civil War in 1885. And he was like a lawyer before. He was the mayor of Buffalo at one point and then later governor of New York. And he came from a large family of nine, born in New Jersey and raised in upstate New York. And then he won the presidency with the support of Democrats and reformed Republicans called the Mugwumps, which reminds me of your story,
yeah.
Which is just funny. Yep. And then I got weird for me. So in June 1886, Cleveland married 21-year-old Frances Folsom. So he was the only president to marry in the White House.
Oh, wow.
So he was a bachelor going in.
How old is he, though?
There's a 27-year age gap.
Always.
Okay. And which made her, Frances, which was also nicknamed Frank, made her the youngest first lady, which was another interesting fact. Yeah. So first marriage, first, you know, youngest first lady. So Frances, there's this article, or online I was looking up the history. So Frances Folsom's parents were law partners with Grover.
Okay.
Okay, so they had been family friends, the president and her parents. So this article had said that he was a devoted family friend, and Grover, the president, bought Frank her first baby carriage.
What the heck?
So here he is buying his friends a baby carriage for the woman he ends up marrying.
That's messed up.
Is that...
That was his first marriage?
First marriage.
He's like old.
Let me show you the picture because.
Oh my gosh.
It's not like he's young and attractive. No offense.
Gosh.
Yep. So I'll post that. So they, after leaving the White House, they retired in New Jersey and they had five children. And 5 years later, he died. Oh no, sorry. He died in 1908 when he was 71, and then 5 years later, she remarried.
Yeah, because what was she, like, 40?
Yeah. So, yeah, so that was just an interesting part of history that linked to my article.
Yeah.
Because, again, all the articles linked back to saying Judson was this, you know, attorney for the president.
Mm-hmm.
So, then we have Judson. So, along with my main character, so her name was Florence B. Harmon, there was five siblings altogether. The father was a Baptist minister, and in one of the censuses in 1860, it said that his personal real estate was $1,000, which when I'm looking back at others in that census, it was like $200, $500, yeah. So obviously well off. And then out of the family, there was a couple lawyers, and there was a doctor. So
yeah,
everyone did well. So
they were doing fine.
Yeah, they were doing fine. So my main character, she was born in Kentucky in 1853, and she died in 1899, again, right before that 1900 census, which just bugs me. But in the census in 1870 that I found her in, she was in school, and they were living in Hamilton, Ohio. And there was a lot of misconception in my story. They were saying, like, she's 40, she's 50, she's 44. But per my research, she was definitely 44 at the time. So, I'm going to just quickly read the story because, again, this is why it captivated me.
Mm-hmm.
So, let me just bear with me here. Let me bring it up. So, it was on Friday last that a tall, thin woman with long hair who had not the complete use of her right eye entered Fiorin's jewelry store. She was apparently about 40 years old and was well-dressed and had the appearance of a person of refinement. She told Mr. Farrand, sorry for the mispronunciation there, but she told him that she wished to look at some diamond rings, both solitaires and some set with other stones. Mr. Farrand took two trays out of a showcase and placed them before her. The woman took one tray towards the window, apparently for the purpose of obtaining better light by which to examine the rings. In a few minutes, she returned it, saying that nothing which had shown her pleasure. She had said that she would return to at some other time and left the store. Mr. Farrand immediately noticed that one diamond ring set with an opal and valued at $75 was missing.
Oh boy.
Yeah. And $75 was about $2,700 today.
Oh.
So, he was for a moment unable to recall whether the tray had been full when he had showed it to the woman, but hastily decided that no rings were missing when he placed the trays before her, and that therefore she must have stolen one. He quickly called to one of the salesmen and told him to follow the woman. The salesman succeeded in getting into the street in time enough to see the woman turning the corner into Broadway. She boarded a Broadway car, and the salesman took a seat in the opposite end of the car.
Ooh.
I know, right?
Good timing there.
Yep. Sorry, I lost my spot here. Let's see. She boarded the car. He went on the opposite side. She rode to Broadway in 25th Street, where she left the car and walked to number 38 West 25th Street, which house she entered. The salesman made sure of the house. After remaining a few minutes and not seeing her reappear, he decided that she lived there. Mr. Farrand went to the police headquarters on Saturday and told Acting Captain McCluxley of the Detective Bureau what had taken place. He ordered them to watch the 25th Street house. The detective saw the woman leave there on Saturday morning and followed her to several jewelry stores in Broadway, among others that of Hammerick & Co. near 18th Street. She remained there a few minutes and then returned to number 38 West 25th Street, where she was living.
Mm-hmm.
She did not leave the house again, and the detectives returned to Hammerick & Co., where they found she had shown a diamond ring corresponding in appearance with the stolen one. She had expressed herself as anxious to have an opal in the ring taken out and an opal which she wished to select from Hammerick stock substituted. She gave her name as Miss Florence Harmon and her residence as number 38 West 25th Street.
Mm-hmm.
O.H. Harmick, with whom she spoke, advised her not to have the opal changed as it was an excellent stone. She replied after a little discussion that she would consider the matter further. Then she went away under instructions from police headquarters. The jeweler was ordered to write to her, advising her that he had a stock of opals, which he thought would satisfy her, and asking her to call. Meanwhile, a trap was laid for her, and when she appeared today, she was arrested and carried off to jail. At her home of 25th Street, it was found she was a sister of ex-Attorney General Harmon. But I could just picture this whole, like, here's a salesman running down the street, turning Broadway, getting in the car. Like, what did he say to her in the car? Like, awkward, right? Peeking out her window. Just, he took action, man. He took action. So, good for him.
That's really good.
So, when I first read this, like, what are your thoughts, too, like, of next things to research? Because I was like, ooh,
I would look up the Attorney General and see, like, if they were, like, is he going to support her or how is that going to go?
So, and then I was curious, is this woman, like a theft? Is this her thing to do?
Yeah.
Are there other stories in her theory of stealing? So, there was I found quite a good amount of other articles, some of which just repeated the same thing, accused of theft. Woman to believe to be Miss Lawrence B. Harmon arrested, took an opal ring, trapped by detectives. So they all kind of shared the same thing there. But to your point, in comes Big Brother? Let me look at the age difference here. Judson was 1840. So Big Brother Judson comes in. He goes from Cincinnati, Ohio, travels to go see her in New York. And there was an article called, it was named Character Studies, said that, she was a victim of insomnia to cure which she had been bicycling to no effect. She had been treated twice for nervous derangement. And she was also the secretary of the Owl Magazine Publishing Co., which she invested $25,000 in.
Whoa.
So it seemed like she also had money and was working at the time.
Was she bored?
I know, right? She was just like, it was another article where she said she was an avid bicyclist and people would see her around around New York on her bike and things like that. But they did go, and one of the other brothers, who was a lawyer, also represented her. Well, he didn't represent her, but his partner did from their law firm. And let's see if I can find the article here. I'll just go through the quick timeline. So she was arrested in 1897 on the charge of stealing diamond and opal ring. Then she was released on bail on September 21st, which was $1,000. And then September 26th, she was dismissed because the jeweler decided not to press charges. And it had been said that the lawyer from Eugene, which is the brother Harmon and Seymour, all of the conversations was taken in the judge's private room, and none of the reporters were allowed to see the papers in the case. So obviously the lawyers did a good job if they were representing you. So that was good. But I just found it very interesting, across all the articles, they kept on talking about her medical history. Give it mental health or whatever it is. They were saying things like the woman had undergone medical treatment, which affected her head. Like I just said, the victim of insomnia, treated twice for that nervous derangement. She was mentally unbalanced. And then it said she had undergone several operations during the past year, which led her unbalanced in her mind. And I'm thinking, like,
did she get a lobotomy?
My first thought was like,
lot of things popping up about articles about, like, people before and after.
And the differences, and if she had been having issues before. So I just was like, my mind went there as well. Yeah. But I couldn't, there's nothing to say that, at least the articles I found to say that happened.
Right.
But let's see here. She, trying to find some other things. Like, one of the lawyers had said that they were going to bring her, remove her to a private asylum after her conditions, improved a little bit. So, I mean, they definitely seemed like they knew she needed help and maybe getting her help down the line.
Yeah.
But the most interesting part that I found was that one of her brothers, and let me get that information, who was the doctor, Frank, the brother, he was a superintendent of the Longview Asylum for 37 years, from 1881 until 1918. So her brother was a practicing doctor at an asylum.
Yeah.
Like a big one. Like, I started doing some research. It was interesting. And he left the institution after a grand jury investigated uncovering serious problems, including two patients who were murdered by the staff.
What?
So Dr. Harmon was questioned, and then he suddenly left town and moved to San Diego, claiming that he was ill, but it seemed like he was trying to avoid charges.
Yikes.
And the weird part was, like, his family grew up, like, on this property, so his, like, kids were born in the asylum, essentially, on the property. Like, imagine what they saw.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, it was, I'm sure there's some minor details that I'm forgetting here, but definitely the story, I think, was just a cool little scene in my head, and then just seeing how well the family was, like, luckily for her, they were able to get her off on a charge quickly, and I didn't see any additional things in the future about her doing anything that she shouldn't have
done. Probably just paid the jeweler off. Like, she could have afforded the ring anyways, so it seems like she was just... Either she wasn't right or she was just...
bored, like you're saying. Just,
I don't know. Like, even nowadays, you see famous people, like, just stealing stuff for the heck of it. Because they can, and they'll get away with it.
Yeah, no, that's true. So, yeah, that's my story. So I'll post a few of these things. I'm sure, there's some things I missed upon. But,
That's very interesting, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, like... families can get you out of it. It's all when you know. And
it's
like,
all about you know.
Yeah. Because if the opposite, like if she was a poor woman and she was stealing a ring probably to like feed her family or something, jail.
Yeah. Exactly.
Hung out to dry, but you know, because her family was well to do and she had brothers who could swoop in and save the day. It's a different story. Still kind of happens now.
I know. Weird parts of society.
Yep. It's a good story, Danielle.
Yeah, thanks. All right, well, I'm curious to see, because there were so many different directions I think you could have gone through with theft and robbery. Like, I saw a lot of, like, train robberies and, you know, which was interesting as well.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's actually a really good lead-in to my kind of research process. So I started with train robberies. I was looking
there
for
were so
train,
many.
And then I was like, "Oh, maybe I'll do like stagecoach, like Wild West stuff." And I kept reading in, and there were articles, but then they said like they were glamorized in the media, and like people just started making it seem like it was this really big life and death, like shootouts and stuff, and they were these big gangs in the Wild West, but. Everyone just kind of knew it was happening and nobody really even, it wasn't as big of a issue as they led on to believe. Like, people would just go be like, okay, the train got robbed again. It wasn't really that important back then, I guess. They didn't
The norm, kind of.
Yeah. So, it would happen a lot in the West. So, I decided I was going to keep looking and then I came across grave robberies.
Ooh.
So, and the title of this one really, really kind of grabbed me. So, is Sexton Hale guilty? Horrible discoveries in connection with grave robberies. The work of ghouls and graveyards to be probed in court probably this morning. Arrest of county Sexton Hale. So, there were accounts that family members brought to like the town deputies and the sheriffs that they noticed issues with the graves of their family members. So
they'll leave stuff probably and then say,
exactly,
hey, this looks a little weird.
Exactly. And the Sexton Hale, so Sextons, I had to look it up, they were in charge of the like groundkeeping and the burials of
the people.
So this specific issue was in Pottersfield in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Okay.
So it was
we haven't hit Tennessee yet.
No,
so.
We haven't hit Tennessee. So Chattanooga, and it was a Pottersfield, which was where paupers, like it was a poor family burial area. So they the families would have their services, go to the sexton and say, please take care of my family member. And then he would act strange. So I'm going to just read a little bit more. Okay. 1 week ago last Saturday, Charles Gowen, or Govan, but just depended on which article I read, a brother of Miss Ida Vaughn, was buried in the Potter's Field. Mrs. Vaughn lives on 213 Grove Street, and the body was taken from her house and buried in a new suit of clothes, a considerable quantity of jewelry, the property of the dead man, and was placed in the grave with him. So that was the first she was, like, trying to make sure all of his belongings stayed with him. So she was trying to push it upon, like, the groundskeepers to, like, make sure you watch over.
Right, keep everything as it's...
Yeah, keep how it should lie. But when the facts of the recent robberies were made public, Mrs. Vaughn became alarmed. On Monday, she went to the cemetery and asked the county sexton to open the grave of her brother.
Wow.
He did not seem willing to open the grave. But finally, in the presence of Mitchell, another sexton there, the grave was opened. When the coffin was reached, it was found that although the lid had been screwed tightly, the original screws had now been loose, and the lid was half off. Raising the lid, they found that the body had been removed and nothing was left but the pillows placed under the head of the dead man by his sister. This grave was the one in regard to which the county sexton at the trial of Jones and Hurst swore that not even the flowers had been disturbed.
Wow.
So there's all these, like, different takes, and the sextons were saying, no, not, they did nothing wrong, and then the families were like,
Something's wrong.
Yeah, we need to open up all these graves to see, like, who's missing, and yeah. So it just kept getting worse and worse for these sextons. So they were being held, but the
both of them.
Yeah, their bail was the sum of $500, and then, the body stealing in this cemetery has reached an interesting point, and the fact of the evidence has been collected for the first trial has been secured. So they were looking into it, and then the judges were like, we need to have more evidence in this. We need to have more people come forward and say, like, we want this done. He can't just, like, order
all these bodies.
So he was waiting for more people to come forward, and they sure did.
Wow.
So in this article, so I know I had mentioned that there was a Mitchell. So right now there were three sextons that were at the Potter's Field. So there was Griffin Jones, and it was William or John Hurst, and then PJ Hale, and then Mitchell was the one who was starting to, like, cause trouble for the ring of grave robberies. So he gave a testimony at the trial. Let me go back
here. It's interesting, because I feel like, because I had done that one article about a sexton, and he was the only one for the whole cemetery. So it's interesting. I guess it must be a very big, big property.
Yep. It's northern Chattanooga Hill City area. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a really, I'm going to read you some history about the area too. So the next article is titled, The Corpse Stealer, Circumstantial Evidence Strong Enough to Convict. The case to be prosecuted vigorously for the welfare of the community. Who lies now, you or me?
Ooh.
So they're just fighting back and forth about who's telling the truth here.
Are they pinning each other against, the sextons against each other?
Kind of, yeah. So this Mitchell is, like, he knows something's up. Yeah. So I'll read you some of his words here. Make sure I get the right one. Yeah, okay. So he was the assistant sexton. So he said that he was employed by the other sextons to work in the field, and he was told to watch for students who might rob the graves, but that they would not go out if they heard any noise at night, because some of the parties, they said that there was people coming to bury a stillborn, and they were a wealthy family, and they wanted to do this in private. Hmm. So if he heard any noise while he was staying overnight to watch, that he shouldn't go out and look, because they had, like, a building or whatever for supply, so he was staying in that building.
That's a weird thing to say.
Yeah. So that was what Hale, Sexton Hale, had told him. So Hale told me that I was hired to watch these people, and if I heard them, I was not to go outside of the house. The second grave witness dug for the body was for a man named Moore on the 28th of last month. While he was digging, the grave witness stated that Jones came to him and asked him if Hale had told him anything. Did he say anything about some little boxes to be buried
there, or if there were small boxes he was just gonna, you know, cover back up? He didn't see any small boxes for, you know, an infant grave, so he kept going, and then he got to the original, you know, grave that they had buried someone in the day before that more.
Oh.
And he noticed the screws were loose, so he lifted, same thing,
gone.
So he was like...
Wait, Mitchell?
Yeah, Mitchell was one of the sexton who was... He was not in on it.
Okay.
Or, so he says.
Okay, he's a little suspicious to me right now, yeah.
Yeah, so Mitchell dug it up and said that, you know, the little boxes weren't there, and he kept looking in, and then at the supply of the witness, he told Sexton that he feared the grave was robbed that night, but Hale told him to rest easy as he would not be hurt. Witness told Hale that if the body was gone in the morning, he would find out who robbed the grave and report it to the officers. The next morning, the witness visited the grave and found it was torn up. So we talked about that. So Jones on the stand denied anything and said that he had not told Mitchell that he had ruined him.
Yeah, so they were starting to like
fight back and forth, saying that he's going to get him fired. And,
oh my gosh.
Like, because this Mitchell guy just started telling people, like, down the street, like, this guy's, like, there's some kind
he's
of...
He's covering himself, I think.
You think so?
I don't know.
You think he's... I don't know. I think they're... Hearst said that he knows nothing about the robbery, so that's one of the other Sextons. Yeah. And he had no conversation with Mitchell on Saturday. Sexton Hale was again called to the stand, and he testified that Mitchell had said nothing to him about the robberies. So they're like... So the defense lawyers are like, we need to get this Mitchell out of here. He's lying. Like,
yeah.
But the judge is like, okay, well, where are the bodies?
Right.
Like,
still have
you're,
to find.
You are all are in charge of these,
right.
This graveyard. So can you, like, let us know what's going on? So there was thought that medical schools were in need of
bodies. My gosh. I feel like this.
Dissections. Yeah.
Wait, what year was this again?
1894. Yeah.
Wasn't this like in a movie or something?
I don't remember.
Whoa. So who's saying that? The judge is saying that as a theory?
No, like this has been in the paper, like from since the beginning. They're saying that.
Maybe the sign. Yeah. For scientists.
Yeah. What? And there's like a known price, like the going rate of bodies. Yeah, I wrote it down. It was between $25 and $60 per body.
So whoever's digging them up is getting the money?
Yeah. Whoever supplies, so they're probably splitting it, the sextons, and yeah. So there's like medical schools, known medical schools in Nashville. There was one in Louisville, Kentucky. So, and these are like brand new institutions that are like needing bodies. And there's another story I'll bring up in a few minutes here that happened in Kansas. So yeah, there was other. So grave robbing clicks, a new phase of common law, accuse the accounted guilty unless they can prove himself innocent instead of vice versa. So people were mad that they were like, they can't prove it, so they're just going to let these guys go. So they just ended up paying a fine and they were released because...
And they kept their jobs.
But they kept digging up, like they dug up, I think, 10 bodies and 9 were missing.
Oh my gosh. So this is like a normal habit.
Yeah. Yeah, so they were selling these poor people's bodies for dissection. So
and then probably keeping their things.
Yeah, like all the jewels, or they sold them and got like other places. Yeah. So I thought that was really awful, and
so that's it. They just got away.
Yeah, basically, there was an article I read that in like 1910, 1911, they wanted to make bigger laws, make it like a felony or.
Oh.
A higher level crime so that they could, you know, institutionalize this as a really, we don't want this happening anymore.
No.
So they brought the case up against Hale again, and he was pretty old by then, and he ended up passing away before they got the law passed, but it was upgraded, so it wasn't just like a pay a fine kind of a crime. Yeah.
And I'd be curious, like, did they stop? They must have stopped. If it were them, they must have stopped doing it.
Did they? I don't know. It just kind of like fell off after 1890. Like it was the end, like November, December of 1894. So I looked a little further into 1895 and there wasn't wasn't much more.
Come on, Michelle. I need some more resolve. That's like, what the heck?
I know.
They're just getting away from getting people's bodies. That's right. Wild.
And then there was, people were really mad in Kansas because the same situation happened in like 1895. Oh, wow. So I put those years in, and this is what came up. Mob was furious, wanted to burn the Kansas Medical College where bodies of women were found. Rage dethrones reason when the discovery of the bodies is made by the people. Two bereaved husbands find bodies of their wives on the dissecting table. And the son identifies the remains of the mother. The military and the police protected, secured. So
that's bad.
Yeah. So they were, it was like a mob of people ready to burn the college down. And it was a newer college, and they were, it was in Topeka, Kansas. So the recent revolting grave robberies in the city has aroused the people to a highest pitch of indignation. At 8 o'clock tonight, a mob began forming in the streets, and the purpose of being to burn the medical college in which during these past 3 days, the bodies of two well-known women have been found, both been stolen from their graves soon after burial. So the governor had to call in the state militia to protect the school from being burned down.
Is that school still around, you know?
I didn't look, but I imagine, like, I looked and, like, after that, there were still people graduating from it. So this was, like, one of the first years that it was open. So it was, like, 3 people graduated this year, and then
jeez, I wonder 4, if, like, the president 5. Of that college got fired, or...
was, Drake was the surname of a husband whose wife died last week, discovered her grave had been robbed and the corpse be found at the school. So then Van Fleet was the other family whose wife was also there, and they just
they were
mad. Sick. Yeah, 3 physicians connected with the Kansas Medical College implicated, so they had names of these people, so
I'll have to post that.
And they were gonna go.
Imagine doing your family research and finding out that one of your family members was used for science on, you know.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's quite the story. These people, I don't think they got the bodies back of those women, but, like, they couldn't find the ones in the first story. Like, they probably sent them to colleges further out away from Chattanooga.
Poof.
Yeah.
That was an interesting one.
Like I said, the stagecoach and the train robberies, they were, like, happening so often.
They were good, but consistent,
it was just, like, the same thing over and over and over.
Yeah. And, this is different. Yeah, this is different.
And I feel like there was a lot of historical movies done about train robberies. Oh, yeah.
And all the Wild West movies. Yeah. Like you said, it was glamorized.
Yeah.
Really.
So. Good. I thought this one was pretty different.
Good, definitely. Well, listen, yeah, we'll post all these and get them up so people can see and read them and find out more information. But if you have any stories wild like this one about your family, or ones you've discovered about your family, reach out to us, because we would love to share and shed some light on, just again, these shadows that we find in our family trees.
Yeah, thanks again for listening.
All right, thank you.